This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Typhoid is most likely going to be with us for a long time. In fact, it has become endemic as long as the local authorities, including the government, do not address the fundamental public health concerns.
That's the executive director for Zimbabwe's Community Working Group on Health on fresh reports of typhoid in the country. Details coming up also. The conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region could destabilize the Horn of Africa. And Zimbabwe's two largest cities are dealing with disease concerns as residents increasingly rely on unsafe water sources. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Ethiopian fighter jets have bombed the capital of Restive Tigray state as the federal government resists international pressure for mediation in the conflict with forces loyal to the Tigray People Liberation Front, TPLF. Officials in Kenya and Djibouti urged a peaceful resolution and the opening of humanitarian corridors, while former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo went to Ethiopia. European nations were also reportedly weighing in, with Norway planning to send a special envoy. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi why there has been an escalation in the Ethiopian conflict that's destabilizing the Horn of Africa.
The tensions surrounding Tigray have been building up really for the past 2 years since Prime Minister Abiy came to power when he sidelined the leaders of the TPLF, who had been formerly running the Ethiopian government for the last three decades. And these Tigrayan leaders regrouped in the northern province of Tigray, you know, which comprises about 6% of the total population in Ethiopia. And they have been increasingly asserting greater autonomy for their region in defiance of national authority. And these tensions came to a head a couple of weeks ago, and we saw the starting of fighting. It's been intense, this conflict, because both sides see it as an existential conflict. You know, they're fighting over the degree of autonomy that the Tigray will have, and the regional leaders fear if they lose, then they will be highly marginalized, and in fact, they'll face reprisals for their many years of repressive rule in Ethiopia. Abiy, meanwhile, sees the need to assert federal authority. He feels that if he's unable to keep Tigray as part of the federal structure in Ethiopia, then other regions within Ethiopia's ethnic federal model will also move to break away. So he sees it as a challenge to Ethiopia's territorial and national integrity. This past week, we saw an escalation of the conflict with Tigray firing artillery missiles into Asmara, the capital of Eritrea, as well as Gondar in the regional capital of Amhara. And you know, these are parts of Tigray's efforts to break out of its isolation. It's surrounded by Ethiopia on the south and east, and Eritrea on the north, and Sudan on the west.
So what prompted the Eritrean forces to get involved in the fighting against the TPLF?
Well, there's been a high level of animosity between Eritrea and the Tigrayan leaders ever since the border war between Ethiopia and Eritrea 20 years ago. That was a very intense battle as well. And in that conflict, there's an estimated 70 to 100,000 people who were killed. And that conflict was never formally ended until Abiy came to office, you know, 2 years ago, and they signed the celebrated peace agreement, and there was a de-escalation. Nonetheless, there remains this high level of animosity between the Tigrayan and Eritrean leaders, and Eritrea wants to reclaim some of the territory that is still controlled by Ethiopia and Tigrayan and the region of Tigray, and which international mediators have said belong to Eritrea. So, you know, there is understanding that Eritrea has been collaborating with Ethiopia, and that some Ethiopian forces may have attacked Tigray through Eritrea. There's also reports that Eritrea may have sent troops into Tigray as well.
The leader of the Tigray region urged the United Nations and the African Union to condemn the Ethiopian government for using high-tech weaponry, including drones, during its nearly two-week military offensive. Abiy, however, has rejected mediation efforts and international calls for an immediate de-escalation. Could the UN or the African Union do anything to stop the fighting in Ethiopia?
I don't think that any international body can physically stop the fighting. However, there is an important role for international mediators to put pressure on all sides to declare a ceasefire and return to a negotiating posture. You know, this conflict did not emerge out of the blue. It has been building up for some time. It gets at very fundamental issues about levels of regional autonomy in Ethiopia as part of its federal system. And these are issues that need to be negotiated as part of some sort of broad national dialogue in Ethiopia. Now, because of the high level of polarization and distrust and now fighting between Tigray and Ethiopia, it's unlikely that they are going to be able to do that on a bilateral basis. They really need some neutral third-party actors to help de-escalate and find a solution. And, you know, I think a strong argument can be made that, you know, no side ultimately wins from this conflict. Political settlement is going to be needed, and better that be reached before more destruction and violence is wreaked on the region.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. As COVID infections reach record numbers in the U.S., the African continent is bracing for a smaller surge after spending the year defying predictions that it would be hardest hit. Medical experts, including White House Coronavirus Task Force member Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention, are at the annual global meeting of tropical medicine experts to discuss what the very different continents have learned from the pandemic. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
When Egypt discovered its first coronavirus case in February, African public health officials sprang into action. A week later, experts from the African Union's 55 member states convened at AU headquarters in Addis Ababa to come up with a plan. 9 months later, Africa's top health leader says that coordinated response spared the continent the worst of the pandemic, with 1.9 million recorded cases, fewer than expected for a continent with such low levels of infrastructure and social safety nets. And, says Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it is proof that this continent is more than capable of battling a pandemic that has overwhelmed other societies.
The key unifying leadership of the continent very early on in February has been a very critical factor in moderating the spread of the virus on the continent. As a matter of fact, if the continent didn't go into a massive shutdown early on in March, with the rates in South Africa, for example, were doubling every 2 days. So I think that would have been a severe pandemic in South Africa.
Nkengasong says the pandemic proves that partnerships matter, and that a cooperative, coordinated approach is necessary to contain the spread of the virus. Dr. Anthony Fauci heads the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in the country hit hardest by the pandemic, the United States. Fauci, speaking to medical experts by video conference late Monday, reiterated the five steps everyone must take to avoid the coronavirus. Wear a mask. Keep a two-meter distance from others. Avoid crowds. Conduct any gatherings outdoors instead of indoors. And regularly wash hands.
If those five public health measures were adhered to universally and consistently over the country, it is clear from our previous experience with other nations and even regions in our own country, we would not be having the degree of surging of cases that we are currently seeing.
In some U.S. states, political leaders have embraced those measures. In others, governors have contested the importance of masks or declined to impose restrictions they say would hurt businesses. Fauci said the result is a surge in cases across the U.S.
Around June 19th, we had the beginning of a resurgence of cases due to the attempts to so-called reopen the economy or reopen the country, which was done variably with regard to adhering to the guidelines which came out. Different states did it differently, and we had a resurgence back up to close to 70,000, went back down, stayed around 40,000 for a while, and now is going up to 86,000 with a mean, I say an average of weekly, somewhere around 80,000. Unfortunately, on November the 4th, we hit 100,000 cases in a single day.
According to the Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. currently has more than 11 million confirmed cases and approaching 250,000 deaths. Meanwhile, Nkengasong notes that Africa's leaders are pushing the prevention measures anew as the continent braces for another coronavirus wave that seems to be emerging, concentrated in Algeria, Tunisia, Kenya, and South Africa.
There's a tale, a very worrying tale is beginning to emerge, and we are recording now about 10,000 cases per day. And very clearly showing that if not, something is not done, we will be getting a second peak sooner than later.
He said, if Africans stick together, in spirit, not physically, the continent will show the world it can beat the virus. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Last week, reports emerged of mass beheadings of civilians by Islamist insurgents in Mozambique's restive and gas-rich Cabo Delgado region. But there is still much we do not know about what took place and how Mozambique's government will respond. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Tom Boker, editor of the Zitamar News website in Mozambique's capital, Maputo.
Tom, since the reports of this massacre last week emerged, what more have we learned?
Yes, I don't think it was probably one incident. I think, you know, tens of people, 50 maybe more, difficult to say, were killed in probably a series of incidents over the course of a week or more. The reports that came through are sort of, you know, reports coming from the field where it's very difficult for people to communicate, and some of them are a bit contradictory. There are reports of mass beheadings on a football field, which for me still remains unconfirmed, but certainly a significant number of people were beheaded, and it's a terrible, terrible situation.
What about reaction? What reaction has there been politically?
In terms of the government response, I mean, officially there's been no comment by most of the competent members of government. The provincial governor of Cabo Delgado said that there hadn't been a massacre. He is not someone who generally would be a government spokesman on what's happening in the conflict. And like I said, I think the reports are unconfirmed, and I don't think necessarily he had the best information when he made that comment. But yeah, there's been no official government response to the reports of the massacre, which is fairly shocking, I suppose.
And what about in terms of investigations? Has there been any investigations into the killings?
Not that I'm aware of. There was a parliamentary commission went up to investigate allegations of human rights abuses just before these attacks on Mudumbe happened. Their focus was, at least in part, on accusations that government forces, the military and the police have been carrying out human rights violations. Parliamentarians of the ruling party conveniently found that the armed forces were correct in saying it was actually the insurgents doing these things and trying to make it look like it was the armed forces. In fact, it's much more likely that it is Mozambique's armed forces that are carrying out some of the human rights violations. Obviously, the insurgents are grossly violating human rights in Cabo Delgado as well. There was a lot of shock a couple of months ago when there was this video of the killing of a naked, defenseless woman, which I suppose is what really prompted that inquiry to go ahead, which has now seemingly absolved the military of carrying out that killing, even though it was pretty obvious from the video that that was actually, it was them who did it.
Mm-hmm. And what's the reaction been by the public to that report, which, as you said, has absolved government forces of blame?
There hasn't been all that much reaction. I don't think anyone's surprised either by the conclusion or by, you know, their own belief of what already happened. Everyone's priors are probably reinforced by the fact that the ruling party say it's not the government forces that are doing it. If that's what you want to believe, then there's another reason to believe it. And if you didn't believe it in the first place, you're probably not going to be convinced either. But yeah, I think there's probably a bit of a sense of resignation and outrage, fatigue by this point. I mean, this conflict has been going on for 3 years with violations by both sides.
So it sounds like even as the violence continues, the response to that violence seems a bit stuck.
Yeah. I mean, the other conclusion of that parliamentary commission is that the government forces don't have the equipment, generally the means, to combat the insurgency properly. And I think that's correct. And I don't know how that's going to change. They have a mercenary organization, a private military contractor from South Africa, who have been providing helicopter support and also ground training for some of the troops, but it's very small. It's not really going to change the course of the war. And I don't know what is, I mean, whether there's going to be a significant outside intervention or whether Mozambique is going to pay for significantly more private military contractors remains to be seen.
That was Tom Boker, editor of the Zitamar News website in Mozambique's capital, Maputo, speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. Zimbabwe's two largest cities are dealing with disease concerns as residents increasingly rely on unsafe sources of water amid widespread shortages. Bulawayo has reported 13 deaths from diarrhea. Harare recently recorded a handful of cases of typhoid, a disease that has often resurfaced time and again in the water-scarce city and also is a concern in Bulawayo. Reporter Kuzai Zenawashi looks at factors behind the repeat of the disease.
Typhoid is a bacterial disease which often spreads through contaminated food, water, and other means. Michael Chideme, the spokesperson for Harare City Council, says this time around, typhoid didn't spread.
There have not been any new cases of typhoid. The only four cases that were reported are the ones that we dealt with.
The containment of the disease is welcome news, but Itai Rusike, executive director for Community Working Group on Health, says it's not going away.
Typhoid is most likely going to be with us for a long time. In fact, it has become endemic as long as the local authorities, including the government, do not address the fundamental public health concerns. If you look at most of our urban areas, the issue of water has become a real challenge. So as long as we don't address the issue of uninterrupted supply of water,
drought has led to water shortages that have left levels in reservoirs dangerously low. In addition, the delivery system is antiquated and economic problems have left the cities with scant funds for water treatment chemicals and repairs. Hardlife Mudzingwa is with the Water Alliance of Zimbabwe. He says access to safe water has left thirsty residents searching for alternatives.
People have resorted to alternative water sources, which unfortunately in some areas are unprotected wells.
Rusike gives an example of Bulawayo, Zimbabwe's second capital, which did not have water shortages until recently. Pondering on solutions, he says the Public Health Act should be respected and the Ministry of Health should intervene every time any urban center goes for 48 hours without running water in the taps. What's more, he says, local authorities need to raise money for water and sanitation from service fees by residents to tackle the root causes of the problems or diseases will continuously resurface. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
The minister in charge of border control in South Africa has appeared in Parliament to explain how a Malawian church leader and his wife fled the country last week. Self-proclaimed prophet Shepherd Bushiri and his wife Mary didn't have passports. Police confiscated them when they were granted bail a few weeks ago for alleged financial crimes involving about $1.2 million. The police say the Busheris bribed border officials to leave South Africa illegally. Darren Taylor reports.
Since 2015, 37-year-old Shepherd Bushiri has amassed a fortune via an evangelical church called the Enlightened Christian Gathering, based in Pretoria. He asserts his and his wife's innocence, saying the charges of fraud and money laundering stem from his refusal to pay protection money to senior police officers. He says they fled to Malawi in fear they'd soon be murdered in South Africa. Home Affairs Minister Aaron Motsoaledi says his officials did their best to convince the magistrate not to give the Bushiris bail.
Our role in this bail hearing of Mr. Bushiri was to provide police with information about the irregular and fraudulent documents that Mr. Bushiri uses. And we emphasize the fact that we regard him as a flight risk who should not be granted bail. I must confess, our worries stem from the fact that is well known. We are suffering porous borders.
The minister also acknowledges that some border guards are corrupt. Motsoaledi says his officials tried for a decade to get a bill passed to strengthen controls at South Africa's ports of entry. It was only passed a few months ago, so he says there hasn't been enough time to clean things up, as he puts it.
We believe people who are a flight risk can go through any of our porous borders where we will not be able to see them. That was our worry, and we presented this information to police, which they duly presented to court. Unfortunately, the court granted 200,000 rand bail each.
So, says Motsoaledi, it's unfair to blame Home Affairs alone for the Bushiri's escape. It happened, he adds, because several systems failed, not least the justice system that gave them a get-out-of-jail-free card. He says the Bushiri stay in South Africa is a web of lies. Mary Bushiri says she's had a South African permanent residence card since 1997, when she says she first arrived in the country as a 10-year-old.
Now, obviously, this is surprising because people don't just get permanent residence permits when they enter the country for the first time. But anyway, she produced it and said no, it was given to her in 1997. On our movement control system, we do not have any records of her entering the country in 1997.
The first time Mrs. Bushiri appears on South Africa's radar, says Motsoaledi, is in 2015. As for Shepherd Bushiri, there's an official record of him entering the country for the first time in 2013.
In 2014, 2015, 2016, Mr. Shepherd Bushiri registered companies and started conducting business. At this juncture, Mr. Bushiri should then have applied for a business visa, as is demanded by the law. But he never did so, meaning that the businesses that he was running were not within the law.
Bushiri owns a global investment company in Johannesburg. His other business interests include an airline, mines, and real estate firms. He maintains his business in South Africa has always been legal. But Motsoaledi says evidence shows the Bushiris are liars.
We reached the conclusion that the stay of Mr. and Ms. Bushiri is not regular. It is through lots and lots of anomalies. And so we need to take back or revoke their permanent resident status.
Motsoaledi says people engaged in legitimate business don't try to conceal their movements in and out of countries and don't carry false travel documents. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehid Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbi Yambaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here. Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC right after the internet.